On June 30th of 2020, Nutanix CEO Dheeraj Pandey spoke with Wamsi Mohan, who is the Managing Director, IT Enterprise Hardware and Tech Supply Chain at Bank of America Securities, where Wamsi is Senior Tech Analyst. This conference call is Bank of America's View from the Top CEO Insight Call.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining our call today. First, obligatory disclosure. Conflict disclosures relating to the individual companies and securities discussed on this call today can be found on the call invitation. I'm Wamsi Mohan, Senior Tech Analyst at Bank of America, and today for our installment of View from the Top CEO Call Series, we're honored to welcome Dheeraj Pandey, Chairman, CEO, and co-founder of Data Center Disruptor and leading hyperconverged provider Nutanix. We're especially delighted that Dheeraj is made time for us again this year following our talk from last year. Dheeraj co-founded the company in 2009, taking it from an innovative startup to now a multi-billion dollar corporation. He brings a long history of technical know-how and leadership in software and data management. He was VP of engineering at Aster Data, which was acquired by Teradata before founding Nutanix. Earlier in his career, he also managed the storage engine group for Oracle, or Exadata, and co-authored numerous patents in the area of distributed databases. Dheeraj holds a BS in computer science from the esteemed Indian Institute of Technology, or IIT Kanpur in India, and I can attest to how hard it is to get in there. Since Nutanix IPO'd in September 2016, the company has grown software and services billings from $770 million annual run rate to $1.5 billion very soon, which is extremely impressive. So Dheeraj, thank you for taking the time to join this call today. We look forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Wamsi, and for the opportunity, and thank you to our investor audience as well for their time.
So Dheeraj, Nutanix has come a long way from selling appliances to aspiring to be the invisible IT infrastructure anywhere. Where are we in this journey, and do you have the resources to compete with the largest of companies that are trying to do this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was just thinking about our 10 years. You know, we finished 10 years last September. This is our 11th year. You know, many which ways, we're very similar to VMware of 10 years. 2008, they did $1.8 billion, and we're pretty close to that. And then there was a recession for them as well because of the global financial crisis, and we face a similar one because of COVID. And then the next 4 years, you know, they grew over from $500 million a quarter to $1 billion a quarter in January of 12. And I think we need to figure out what the next 3-4 years mean for us. Now, obviously, we are still two different companies. You know, they were into compute virtualization and then finally got into, you know, management and such. And we are a data company first, so we don't need as many hosts to run our licenses to be able to get to the same top line. And data is hard. You know, it's very, very unique advantage that we actually have because people pay for highly reliable, highly available data management. And the way we brought it to the server with hyperconvergence and provided a ton of autonomy to the application administrators like, you know, Oracle and Splunk and Citrix and so on, I think really was the definition of the first decade. Now, as we look to the next decade, Wamsi, you know, this idea of cloud as hardware, when I say hardware as facilities, big hyperscaler data centers and so on, that train has already left the station. So to us, the competitive advantage has to be about software. You know, can Nutanix be the cloud software company with respect to not just being able to deliver it anywhere and everywhere, but also being amorphous? You know, we can inject ourselves anywhere and everywhere, be this company that really helps our customers in the journey towards making computing invisible, i.e. simple, like Apple-like, you know, secure because of all the reasons that we understand security to be a big requirement. And finally, being seamless, where it's really multi-cloud. You know, it's running on-prem, it's running on the edge, it's running in the large hyperscaler data centers. And the value of having a singular experience is where we are focused on. So we are looking at this as a blue ocean of what we could be, you know, in the next 4 years. What does it mean for us to become a $3-5 billion company on our own, where the hyperscaler hardware is the new platform. You know, as a company, we started out with appliance, as you mentioned, but then over time, we realized that the only way to grow our TAM is to really open up the software to other OEM servers, and that's why we opened up to Dell like 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and then to Lenovo and HPE and, you know, Fujitsu and so on and so forth. So I think we've done a really good job of becoming as ubiquitous as the software could be. And, you know, the analysts probably are still confused about what is this thing? Is it hardware? Is it an appliance market? Is it a software? And we think that this is all about software. And we were always about software. But, you know, early on we had to support an appliance because nobody wanted to support this architecture. We were cannibalizing a big portion of the data storage market. Over time, we've cannibalized the virtualization market. And we feel like we're in the very early innings of this. So if we can become friends with all the platform companies, whether it's server platforms or it's hyperscaler hardware as a platform, we can do this independently as well.
Okay, thanks for that, Dheeraj. So, COVID-19 is really being viewed as having accelerated companies shift to the public cloud. Do you agree with that notion? And how do you view the opportunity in the marketplace given these recent developments?
Yeah, I mean, in one way or the other, there was supposed to be a contraction cycle, you know, in our economy. Last time it was because of the housing bubble. This time it's because of COVID. We feel it's a very good opportunity to bite-size infrastructure. And I think subscription is the core of this. If you go back 10 years, 12 years, why virtualization picked up from just being a niche test and dev use case, which is what most of virtualization was useful for back in 2007 and 2008, to, well, we've got to use virtualization for every project, whether it's database, Microsoft virtualization, or Exchange, or SQL, or eventually in 2011, 2012, you know, it went on for SAP and Oracle. I think there was a massive push to use software-defined techniques, and back in the day, it was the cloud of its time, virtualization. You know, I think there's a very similar move this time around as well. The only difference is that economics will matter, and that's why we are not going to take sides. You know, if people want to really lift and shift to a private cloud, we'll help them in that move, and people want to lift and shift to the public cloud, we'll help with that as well. But you're very right. I think this idea of hands-free IT is real and here to stay. And the only way to do hands-free stuff is to really operate a cloud environment. We helped our customers in the journey towards infrastructure consolidation in the last 10 years. And I think there's two more consolidation waves, one of them already underway with data center consolidation. But eventually there'll be a cloud consolidation as well, because there's just a proliferation of so many cost centers because of credit card consumption models and so on. Being that layer of software that provides this singular experience on-prem and off-prem is a very, very unique opportunity for a software company like ours.
That's a really interesting point. So, Dheeraj, as you think about the way people are working with COVID-19, can you talk to us a little bit about the products in your portfolio that are perhaps shaping the way, enabling people to do this work remotely?
Yeah, I mean, as a service matters, and I talk about ourselves as a software company, but we've done a really good job of being a very subservient company to our customers. And, you know, subservience, you know, one of the key terms there is service. There's a reason why our Net Promoter Score is 90 for the last 6 years, because we've been extremely service-oriented with our customers. Even though we have shipped software on-prem and we've shipped appliances before that, and we support our customers on OEM servers, and now we're going to support them on Amazon and Azure, but this subservience to the customers is the key to any company going forward, with an extremely high retention rate and a very low churn, extremely high customer satisfaction, I think, will be key. HCI will morph into HCI as a service. You know, we believe that when we deliver our core digital platform in the public cloud servers, I think that will be a great way to lift and shift. Because if you think about it, what made virtualization popular were two assertions that VMware made back in the day, 2003, 2005. No change to the application, no change to the operating system. And that was powerful. You know, no change to the application, no change to the operating system. And that's how people lifted and shifted from hardware to virtual machines. And I think the same thing happened with storage as well, with storage virtualization in the last decade. I think we have to now virtualize the entire data center and use lift and shift with this assertion, no change to the application, no change to the operating system. But now there's a third one, no change to IT workflows. Because you can't have fragmented skill sets. You know, some people who only know on-prem and hog hardware, and yet others who actually are aware of Amazon, and some others who are only aware of Azure, while others are aware of Google. I think, you know, this need for a very common set of skills so that you can drag and drop entire data centers from one to the other will be paramount. And I think the way we are going about it is to say, look, you write your software once, you write your IT automation once, and you run it everywhere. So I think it's going to become a very key part of most of the enterprises' way of thinking about this. And, you know, I think it all starts with the U.S. Innovation begins in the U.S., and then disruption also begins in the U.S. because you end up spending so much with incumbents that you have to think about, you know, firing your supplier and virtualizing your environment. So I think it's ripe for innovation, this idea that you can really lift and shift from the private to the public, from on-prem three-tier architectures to a private cloud is basically a great opportunity.
So, Dheeraj, let's dive into that a little bit, right? So there has been more of a consensus around a hybrid multi-cloud sort of infrastructure over time. Well, what's your view on hybrid versus public? And when customers sort of think about this lift and shift, are you actually seeing customers move workloads across various clouds, or is it an issue where it just prevents public cloud lock-in and it's the insurance that companies want?
Yeah, in fact, you know, history is a great friend because, you know, we can't surmise enough, you know, nobody the crystal ball, but, you know, history doesn't repeat, it certainly rhymes, as someone told me. Java was a great way to abstract the hardware away from the application so you could build portable applications. It's not like people wanted to move every day from one platform to another simply because they had Java. It just meant that as and when they needed to move systems from, let's say, Sun Solaris to Intel, or from HP UX to Intel, or from IBM AIX to Intel, they could do it in 6 days, not 6 years. You didn't have to rewrite the app at all. And I think that's what, you know, customers would covet, is the way we look at it, that they would be looking for a Java-like portability for their entire infrastructure. And that doesn't mean that they'll keep moving stuff back and forth every day. That will mean that they'll have disaster recovery sites that are cross-cloud. You know, maybe on-prem is one site and the other site is a disaster recovery site. Maybe they'll have edge applications where they want to keep most of the data, but they'll stream the summaries and the aggregates and roll-ups to a public cloud for historical analysis. So we're going to have to really look at this in a nuanced way. I mean, I always believe in trifectas. You know, one of the trifectas that will define the computing architecture for the enterprise will be laws of the land. You know, compliance and sovereignty is king, especially as we see globalization being redefined in the last 3 years. Laws of physics, you know, you can defy the data gravity requirements. You know, if you're going to generate a ton of data at the edge, then you cannot backhaul all that stuff to a large data center. And then finally, laws of economics. You know, there are things that are predictable that are much cheaper to own than to rent. So the good thing, Vamsi, is that we have built an amazingly agnostic architecture with subscription where we don't care. And our sellers wouldn't care, you know, whether our licenses are being run on-prem or off-prem. And in many ways, I think it's going to come back to business-wise, do we have an architecture that will not take sides in whether it's going to run at the edge, run in the private cloud, or run in the public cloud.
So, Dheeraj, you mentioned on your last earnings call that being the best to market is important to you as opposed to just being first to market. Can you give us an update on Nutanix clusters? How does Nutanix clusters really differentiate from other competing solutions, and what sort of feedback have you received from customers on this?
Yeah, I mean, look back 10 years, even 8 years, 7 years, you know, what we were doing with hyperconvergence was a toy it was a toy compared to these massive coalitions of V-blocks and FlexPods, converged infrastructure. And I mean, Gartner had a magic quadrant around converged infrastructure, and we would have to plead with these analysts to say, hey, we think hyperconvergence with pure software running on commodity servers and commodity networks and commodity storage is the way to go. And we had to prove it. You know, initially it was all about, well, maybe it's a good thing for the mid-market. Maybe it's good for virtual desktops. Maybe, maybe, maybe. And I think we had to keep plowing it through to keep growing our TAM, keep distributing our software to multiple servers. And finally, converged infrastructure went away. And we displaced converged infrastructure everywhere because it used to be like this hypocritical notion of a private cloud when it was barely anything more than just a rack with the joint 1-800 customer service number. I think what we did was architectural, and we never hacked our way into that architecture with commodity servers, commodity storage, commodity networks. And the best thing is that that religion around commodity everything is going to greatly help us in the hyperscalers environment too, because all they have is commodity, commodity servers, commodity storage, commodity networks. And the way we are doing it, again, architecturally in the public cloud, is not to try to build our own service, which becomes a black box service. Now, what does it mean if you were to just build a black box service? That means that our on-prem licenses cannot be ported to the public cloud. Ideally, people want to say, look, what I buy, I should be able to use it anywhere. So we had to keep that in mind. It had to be a huge invariant so people don't create silos of budgets and silos of people and silos of operators for public versus private. I think the second piece was that it had to run in the native fleet. What I mean by native fleet is there's a commodity server that, you know, Amazon and Azure are rolling out everywhere, and there's 1,500-odd global data centers. And we had to be extremely flexible about that so that we have global rollouts of our entire product portfolio every time Amazon and Azure add some hardware variant on their side. And lastly, I think we had to make sure that hyperconvergence was never compromised. So what do I mean by that? You know, 10 years ago, Vamsi, we argued that the network is the real enemy. And it really worked both ways. You know, there was a network with network attached storage, and there was a network which was fiber channel storage, you know, which was really expensive storage. And both of them were enemies of the application folks. Why? Well, one of them was slow and unpredictable, which was NAS and network attached storage because of issues with Ethernet. And the other one was not just expensive, it was highly bureaucratic, you know, EMCs and, you know, the stuff that you had to do with fiber channel networking and storage arrays and provisioning and all sorts of things would take weeks, if not months, to provision for application folks. So one side was a problem in performance and predictability. The other side was a problem with performance and predictability of people and projects and so on. So when we argued for network being the enemy and we brought all the storage into the server, it provided immense autonomy to the application folks. In the hyperscaler's environment, the network is the enemy one more time because it's virtualized network and it's going to be pretty challenging to make it all work for all the enterprise legacy apps built in the last 20 years. And that's why we are extremely confident that if you work on the native fleet of the hyperscalers, but at the same time we deliver enterprise-grade data management, enterprise-grade compute, and enterprise-grade operations management, I think we'll be in great shape. We can have the best of both worlds. People can continue to use their cloud commits and cloud credits, which is, again, architectural. You know, we wanted to make sure that people don't have to spend again on hardware. If they've already committed for the next 3 years to Amazon and Azure, what's the best way to co-opt their cloud commits and credits so they don't at least have to buy hardware again? And on that stuff, can we run our portable licenses that could run both on-prem as well as off-prem? I think is extremely architectural. It's going to be the differentiation of this decade for us. And just like hyperconvergence 10 years ago, you know, we have to go and make this extremely seamless.
So, Dheeraj, you mentioned, you know, sort of really getting to that next leg of revenues, similar to how VMware scaled over time. What do you feel is needed in your product portfolio to accomplish that?
You know, by and large, the product portfolio is pretty close to being, I would say, complete. There's always going to be things we do on networking and security and such. You know, this idea of delivering everything as a service is, again, a very important piece. So I think there'll be a lot of things that we'll do to evolve our current portfolio. But the biggest revolution that Dustin is also very passionate about, he talks about this too, is the business model. You know, the business model change has been one of the most rare things done in IT, actually. Nobody in IT moved from hardware to software subscription in a matter of 3 to 5 years, and we would actually end up doing it. And I was looking at Autodesk's history, and I was surprised that they started doing this stuff in 2003 and completed it in 2019. I'm like, wow, I don't think we have that kind of a time, given how the world is moving to cloud and as a service consumption model. So in many ways, I think this was upon us to have done this so much faster. And I think it's going to be one of our biggest friends is this business model change of how, not just during the recession, you talked about COVID impact. I think if we can really go deliver bite-sized infrastructure, you know, the three-year terms moving from 5 to 3 years would be huge. Even sometimes, you know, foot-in-the-door one-year stuff, like the way foot-in-the-door virtualization happened in 2008 or the way public cloud created these bite-sized things that people could try out before really having to commit to it for 5 years. I think it's going to be one of the greatest friends in our overall go-to-market side.
Dheeraj, so maybe that's a good segue to talk about the subscription model benefits, right? Like, how is it beneficial to Nutanix, to your customers, and frankly, to your investors?
Yeah, I mean, on the let's start with customers. You know, when we moved from hardware to software, Wamsi, we grew our TAM, which is great for us, but we also gave optionality to our customers because they said, look, I'm already deeply committed to Dell or HP or Lenovo or Fujitsu or NEC in Japan. And we said, fine, you know, I think we can make our servers, you know, our software run on those servers. And all of a sudden, they could actually mix and match stuff. So they could, you know, negotiate with us separately. They could negotiate with the server vendors at scale as well. And it was a win-win. I think subscription will be great to grow our TAM simply because now we can take the same licenses to the public cloud. All of a sudden, it opens up a new surface area for us to really go and spread the snow, which is our core digital infrastructure, our core business. And we'll make it look exactly the same. And once we do that, you know, customers can really go do lift and shift all day long that they would like without really having to create new spend and new budgets and carving out new skill sets, actually. I think for the customers, it also means that they have fewer fragmented budgets. You know, it's like, well, this is for private, that is for edge, and this is for public. No, it's like, you know, you have one spend. And in fact, if anything, the public cloud folks want to do the same where they're trying to bring computing infrastructure on-prem by saying you can have one single bill, one single identity, one single payment, and you can figure out where you want to run this. We are trying to come from the other side, from private to public, and I want to provide this completely unfragmented view of spend and single panes of glass for managing all of it. And I think for the sellers as well, our sellers cannot be confused about private versus public, you know. If it has to be hybrid, it has to be honestly, authentically hybrid, where they don't care whether licenses are consumed here or there. It also makes our sellers be very friendly with the hyperscaler sellers because HCI can be the killer app for consumption in the public cloud. You know, what better thing to consume in the public cloud than compute, storage, networking, and security? There's nothing bigger than data in terms of consumption in the cloud, actually. So we can really help the hyperscaler sellers as well in terms of consumption of all the cloud commits or cloud credits that they're actually selling. And finally, I think for the investors, you know, including for the company, we become more efficient. You know, going from 5 years to 3 years is actually, you know, it looks like a small thing, but all of a sudden, we can discount less. Maybe it's going to be 5% less discount, and that's huge. That's like 20 to 30% improvement in our overall business if we just discounted 5% less going from 5 to 3 years. It also means that renewals can start happening quicker. And as Dustin has talked about in the past, I think as a company, that's the one last bastion that we did not exercise this last decade on renewals itself. Most of our business right now is not renewals. More than 90% of our business is new and upsell, which is great from one point of view because our sellers have actually been used to hunting. But I think in the future, we can really create a very hedged and diversified model of revenue and billings where over the course of the next 5 to 7 years, half our business could just be renewals. And that is a very different cost of sales than new and upsell. So I think all in all, it's a win-win-win. It's not easy, as you've seen in the last 18 months of our transition. You know, sometimes you commit some mistakes. And I think that's the reason why many public companies don't go through this kind of, relatively complicated stuff. You know, it's like you're in the arena and everybody's watching you and it has to be picture perfect. But at the same time, we're pretty close. I think we've gone through a lot of the pain. And now, over the next 3 years, we believe a lot of the gains will actually come.
So, Dheeraj, just to segue a little bit into this renewal dynamic, right? I think there was some confusion post the call around visibility in revenue, given the comments that, you know, just articulated around renewals versus what is perceived as recurring revenue. So could you maybe just spend a moment talking through how you think investors should think through that in terms of the visibility in the business and also sort of what the recurring revenue is relative to sort of this low rate of current renewals?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so almost half our business is deferred. As you know, we have more than $1.1 billion in deferred revenue that grew 34% year over year. So definitely we actually pack a lot in the balance sheet, as opposed to many companies on-prem that try to squeeze everything into the current quarter. So we've done a really good job of that, but it does still have a cost of sale because we're paying our salespeople for all that money because we collect it all upfront. And I think with the new renewals that we're talking about, when the subscription comes up for renewal, it's going to be a different team working on it. And our field reps, our account executives in the field will focus on annual contract value. Now, that doesn't mean that they'll do one-year terms because it's pretty complicated to go back next year and renegotiate and so on. So I think there's a happy median in 3 years, which is where our business over the course of the next 3 to 5 years will come to stabilize. But the important thing here is that the way we have talked about renewals of the future, it's more about cost of sales and the focus of our field reps on hunting for 3 year terms, maybe some 1 year terms and some 5 year terms, mostly around 3 to 3.5 kind of number. And then when it comes up for refresh, there's another team that actually does the farming with respect to renewals, very much like normal SaaS companies, normal cloud companies, actually. Now, that being said, as I said, I just want to come back and say that we have done a pretty good job of almost 45 to 50% of our business being deferred. So we do have good visibility into revenue, but we'd like to do something similar on billings as well.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So Dheeraj, can you maybe just give us some color on the actions which have been taken by your new worldwide sales leader, Chris Ketteris, over the last year and a half or so to drive the improved execution in the field and what is it that has been done? What is it that still needs to be done?
Great question. You know, obviously, Chris has been around for the last 3.5 to 4 years now and has seen EMEA for a couple of years, then obviously saw Americas before he took over the worldwide role. I think the biggest thing that I can think of, Wamsi, is discipline. And that discipline obviously comes across the board from leading indicators like pipeline to I would say middle indicators like coverage and segmentation and things of that nature to, you know, just downstream indicators, you know, of repeat business and what's going on in terms of churn and attrition, all that stuff. He's done a pretty good job of talent coverage and pipeline. And he talks about his trifecta being talent coverage and pipeline. You know, it's easier said than done, but an amazing leadership that we've actually gotten in the last several years from him. I think the other piece is around this transformation, which again is not easy. I mean, there's a reason why there's such few companies. In fact, we're the only ones who've gone from hardware to software. You know, we had to lose some salespeople who were only hardware sellers to software sellers. And now we are saying, look, you've got to convert this to subscription and really educate the sales force on things like annual contract value and such. So I think he's been extremely instrumental in the transformation of the business model as well. I think in the last 3 months, again, we needed amazing leadership in terms of virtual selling, in terms of digital selling, in terms of remote selling, and what he's actually done and shown. And you saw a lot of that in Q3 numbers too, is how we've held up our business and even pivoted a little bit to end-user computing, virtual desktop infrastructure, because, you know, the future of work, the future of education, future of healthcare, they were challenged in the last 3 months and probably will be a big opportunity for us in the future. But really being able to go and pivot the business to go refocus on end-user computing, which had become like less than 20% of our business to where it is right now, it was 26, 27% of our business, required a lot of agility that Chris brought to the table.
Okay, that's helpful color, Dheeraj. So a question I get a lot is really how you think about the trade-off between growth and profitability. You alluded to, you know, a very large TAM ahead of you. So can you put that a little bit into context in terms of how you think about the TAM and also the trade-off between growth and profitability?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a very important piece of the puzzle on Nutanix. The overall GAAP profitability is a number that's misconstrued in our case because we defer so much. We could easily defer a lot less and try to have a much better P&L, but at the same time, we figure that we need predictability for the future. So that's an important piece of this. Now, I also want to take a step back. But in 2015 and 2019, you know, we went from 100 million to a billion two or billion three, some such number in top line. And all we burned was $75 million of free cash flow. So as a company, we've been very disciplined about making sure that they are not a zero-sum game, growth and profitability. Now, we did want to move to subscription. So 2019 and 2020 have been different. But it's also to make sure that we did not go and make future a hostage. We knew that cloud was here. We knew subscription had to be the name of the game. So we had to do what we had to do on free cash flow. We had to compress the terms. You know, it was a very important piece of this subscription transition. So it's only in the last 12 to 18 months that we've started to burn cash again. And it is very deliberate. We believe that rather than have the customer be our investor forever, because that's what they've been, you know, we've in some sense, raise money from our customer by doing longer-term deals and collecting all of it up front, to a model where we can do three-year deals and be a more profitable business. So a lot of what you're seeing with subscription is around efficiency and profitability. It wouldn't show right now, this quarter, but over the course of the next 3 years, we want to become like a normal SaaS company. But it won't come for free, I think. You know, there's no such thing as free lunch. You know, you've got to or give up something in the present to really get that in the future.
So, Dheeraj, you know, investors are somewhat worried about the cash burn rates, right? And I appreciate the comment about only $75 million or extended period of time. People are worried that there needs to be some way that you guys would need to have to raise capital given what the company's ambitions seem to be. So what would you say to that, and what are some of the preferred ways that you would contemplate this if needed?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest one is a public convert, and Dustin has talked about this in his couple of previous conference appearances as well, that it's a pretty open market, and it's really up to us. We still have a good amount of cash in the bank, and it's going to be on our terms. And we feel like in the future, which is not a distant future, we'll probably have to go and do something of that nature as we especially go through this ACV transition, which is the right thing to do for the long term. I think it's pretty accessible to us. So we're just going to do it in our terms and our time. Actually, one thing we are saying is that it's not like the markets are going to close. So let's do the right thing, and hopefully FY21 is that year where we do that.
Would you contemplate, Dheeraj, any, you know, not accessing the public markets for this? Maybe through a strategic partner or something else like that?
I won't speculate on anything right now simply because I think the cheapest money right now is a convert, and it is the easiest to get. But, you know, I think you never say never. You know, there's always going to be investors out there who want to help with the transformation, who believe in things 3 years out. So we'd love to talk to them as well.
Okay, great. Switching a little bit to the customer base, Dheeraj, what trends are you seeing from repeat customers, either expanding into additional parts of the product portfolio or implementing, you know, more of the products they already have and sort of, you know, giving you higher wallet share? Are you seeing any changes to your churn rate under this COVID-19 scenarios?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, COVID definitely was a moment of reckoning for every technology company out there. And what we are seeing from our customers is this: we need great customer support. We need highly reliable products. And by the way, someone needs to help us in this transition to what it means to be a cloud customer, whether it's lift and shift to the private cloud or lift and shift to the public cloud. So I think in that way, it's this pandemic has actually been good. I shouldn't say that in those words, though, I'm sorry. But I think it's been a moment of reckoning for the company. And the products that have actually really stuck is obviously the core product. Working on HPE, for example, has been a hot-selling product for us. Frame, which is our desktop as a service product, you know, a ton of customers last quarter. We're actually seeing a huge traction for not just VDI, which is are attached with Citrix, and even on VMware Horizon, but for desktop as a service. And it's a whole pyramid of, you know, end users out there. You know, when I look at the pyramid, there's folks who, you know, just like VPN, you know, they're like, give me a laptop and I'll just use VPN to connect to my office environment. There are folks who would need virtual desktops, which means that it's sitting in the on-prem environment. And there are folks who are probably task workers who are more the base of the pyramid users who would be really happy with desktop as a service running in any cloud, whether it's running in Amazon, Azure, GCP, or on-prem servers too. So we've seen a really good traction with end-user computing. Even disaster recovery as a service, you know, our Xylee product has done pretty well in the last 3 to 6 months because people are looking at business continuity as one of the big drivers of hands-free IT. And our files product has kicked off to a new level in the last 3-4 quarters because, you know, one of the things that people expect from us is be the best at data. You know, of course you do virtualization and you folks make it invisible and everything else, but with respect to data, databases, you have to be the best at it. So we have seen two really good products to emerge in the last year, even in the last 6 months, I would say. Files and Era. Era is our database as a service product. We're working really closely with not just our customers who are looking at Oracle deployments and Microsoft SQL deployments and even open source Postgres. I mean, a ton of financial service companies who are looking at open source farms with Postgres. They're looking for an enterprise-grade infrastructure to really make Postgres be enterprise-grade. So database as a service, desktop as a service, and unstructured data. I think these are the three places we're seeing a ton of traction.
Got it. That's helpful. Maybe you're shifting gears a little bit. During COVID, obviously, we've seen a lot of the workforce work from home. What's your view on the productivity at both an R&D and sales perspective? And would you care to share any color on, you know, what the recent trends have been in terms of demand, especially given that, you know, now we're starting to see some states open up, but also offset by, you know, some backtracking a little bit.
Yeah, I try to draw a metaphor, an analogy here, Vamsi, because again, we don't have a crystal ball. I feel like we'll be in a hybrid world going forward. I think the last 3 months has come to prove that many employees are happy working from home. And depending on the demographics, you know, some of this is also demographics of the population, employee population. Obviously, all our workers are digital. Our customers are willing to do a lot of things digitally as well. Will obviously need to test this out with the new logos and new customers because it's hard to build a relationship over a video conference call. But when it comes to our developers, R&D, I think there's going to be a bell curve of people. And surprisingly, a large percentage of those are actually waiting for the vaccine and or are saying, look, I can't come to work until the cases have subsided. So given all that, I feel like, you know, if you look 3 years out, it's going to look very much like cloud computing. You know, and again, I draw the analogy of what will happen to facilities, office facilities. They'll look a lot more overcommitted, which is how public cloud data centers are. You know, there'll be very few dedicated cubes and dedicated spaces. There'll be some for those who want to come every day. And you know, in the public cloud, we see that. We call it dedicated instances, reserved instances. We're going to see the exact same thing in facilities too. But most things will be basically unassigned and people come in and just use them. And in fact, there's going to be a large chunk of spillover in coffee areas and conference areas and stuff like that for folks who want to just hang out outside. You know, and it's very similar to the way public cloud actually works. And then your home becomes your private cloud, actually. You know, and I think that bell curve is what we are preparing our workforce for. We're not going to take sides, just like we're not going to take sides with our products. And it also opens up new avenues and opportunities for the workforce. I mean, we already had a pretty distributed workforce, even in R&D and support, but I think sales obviously was always distributed. But I think R&D, the fact that we can deliver it from San Jose and Seattle and Durham and Serbia and Berlin and Bangalore and Pune says a lot. I mean, you know, same things, you know, on support side, you know, all the way from Sydney and Tokyo to San Jose to Durham to Amsterdam to Serbia to Pune. I think we've done a pretty good job of having global consistency with a distributed workforce. And I was looking at our R&D spend recently, and I was comparing it to a contemporary company that's also 10 years old, and they just build one product, maybe a second product, you know, it's a hardware company. They spend more money than we do. And I realized the reason we have such a rich product portfolio is because we were so good at distributing our workforce to work outside of San Jose. This is 7-8 years ago, actually. We said we're going to architecturally move this to a global model where the global team members don't feel like second-class citizens. And it's really hard to do. If you don't have it in your DNA, you'll always look at non-headquarters people as second-class people, actually. So I think that's going to be a big competitive advantage for Nutanix over this coming decade.
So, Dheeraj, if we could talk a little bit about the competitive landscape. I mean, HCI looks like it's really a sort of a two-horse race between Nutanix and VMware. What are the main reasons where you win versus them versus when you lose? And how should we think about your competition beyond HCI? And frankly, are there natural partners for the business? I mean, Dell has VMware and HP has SimpliVity. And do you see any natural partners as well?
Yeah, I mean, you know, two-horse race has always been here. If you go back to hypervisors, it was a two-horse race. You know, VMware was the best at what it did, and Microsoft Hyper-V was supposed to be for the mid-market and folks who didn't want to spend too much. It was bundled with Windows as a virtualization technology. And, you know, same thing with even phones. I would say that Apple and Android, in some sense, was a two-horse race. And I think there's a very little room for a third one. Let me just put it that way. And it's been true for pretty much most things in life. I mean, John Chambers used to call it, if you're not the first and the second, you get out of the business. I think it's very true. Even, you know, if you look at open source, you know, there was Linux and then there was FreeBSD, and it didn't survive for too long. And similarly, when it came to databases, MySQL and Postgres. So we can go and talk about a lot of this stuff. It's going to be a two-horse race in most markets out there. Now, the question is, are they the exact same product? And that's where the nuance is. You know, as a company, we are a data company first. And if we didn't do the hardest problems in data, again, it's databases, unstructured data, you know, big IO intensive workloads, which are mission critical, then we wouldn't have a business. And that's not the same as VMware. You know, VMware can have a business because EMC can deliver hardware to manage data, while VMware can do an also-ran job of data. It's really, really hard to be a data company that cannibalizes your mothership, actually, you know, which for us, we can freely go and do. And that's where the money is. That's where the reliability issues are. That's where the enterprise-grade issues are. I mean, look, I talked about database as a service. It's one of the fastest-growing products for us simply because it's a hard problem. And we'll do it in a multi-cloud way. People can take database as a service to run in factories, shop floors, to on-prem private cloud, to off-prem public cloud. And that's the power of Nutanix, actually, you know. So that's how we go win a lot. We go win with extremely serious workloads. We don't have a hedge on any other architecture. You know, it's supposed to be hyper-converged all day long. We cannot spill over into hardware, which is proprietary. And in the public cloud, it's going to be the exact same thing. We cannot spill over into the public cloud's block storage service or file service. We have to do everything with a standardized equipment, whether it's on-prem or off-prem. And that's how we differentiate. I think both companies actually have a different path. You know, they have gotten deeper into networking and security and trying to make money off of that. For us, I think networking and security has to be simple, easy, lightweight. And as an insurgent, that's all we can do. We can't go and sell multi-million dollar network virtualization software. The public cloud doesn't sell network virtualization software as a multi-million dollar deal. Network is a means to an end, or security is a means to an end, not an end in itself. So I think for us, the strategy on networking and security is to make it simple, lightweight, developer-friendly, application administrator-friendly, as opposed to going and making it into a thing. And we'll go deep after data compared to VMware, actually, you know, and make it run anywhere and everywhere is a really, really hard problem. You know, the people who interview from VMware come to us, engineers, development managers, who are like, how do you do this, where you're portable across all the server platforms and have a consistent customer experience? It's really, really hard. What we did by porting it across different server vendors and still saying, look, we're agnostic to it. While VMware is going closer and closer and closer to just Dell, they are becoming more of a hardware company in that sense, actually. You know? So what we have embarked upon is a hard problem. Subscription, really, really hard. You know, as I said, you know, they are 13%, and they are close to 84% as of last quarter. It's architectural. We're trying to focus on the architectural things so that 3 years down the road, we don't look back and say, now we just got to keep acquiring companies to grow our revenue or top line or something, you know. So I think these things to us are fundamentally pay the tax now so you don't have to really go and think about doing hacks later.
That's interesting perspective. I was wondering if you'd care to comment on sort of the journal article around Dell doing some strategic actions with VMware. How do you think about that if you think about it at all, and any comments that you might want to share on that?
Again, hard to speculate. It's a complicated arrangement. There are tax implications for the next 15 months. Again, it could go either way. I mean, they could completely spin it off or they could completely spin it in. And I think Michael knows what he's doing. You know, he is so savvy at this stuff that I can it's perilous for me to predict. What I do know, though, is that the notion of cloud software becomes important. Because, look, cloud as a hardware, when I say cloud as a hardware, big facilities, big data centers, that train has left the station. So there's no point becoming that anymore, as I mentioned before. The important thing is, what is cloud as an amorphous software that runs anywhere and everywhere? And that's where everybody's interest is right now. You know, can we disperse the cloud? Can we bring it on-prem? Can we take it to the edge? Can we take this software and run it in the public cloud so that lift and shift becomes easy? I think as a market segment, cloud software becomes a very important piece of the puzzle. And, you know, I go back to time again because you can learn so much from history. You know, when VMware was growing from $1.8 billion to $4 billion in 2008 and 12, there was a $55 billion server hardware market. There was a $30 billion storage hardware market. There was a $25 billion networking hardware market. And all they said was, look, I'm not competing with that $110 billion. All I'm looking at is a way to virtualize, simplify, and integrate. And that's why I deserve $4 billion a year. And that's how we have to look at this, that look, at the end of the day, cloud software is not out there to compete with that 100, 110, 150, whatever that number is, billion. The question is, can you build software that virtualizes, simplifies, and integrates for a singular experience?
That's really interesting. Food for thought, Dheeraj. I know we're coming up close to the top of the hour. Maybe two more questions, if I could. What's your view on consolidation trends in the industry? I mean, it looks as though, you know, we spoke about ATI, about market dominance, two players in the market. How do you see consolidation trends progress, especially when capital is so cheap and, you know, this next decade probably sees a lot of companies that either don't have a growth strategy or enough of a, you know, product portfolio to singularly succeed? How do you view consolidation?
I mean, you know, you answered the question, you know, capital is cheap, and there's a baton passing that's going on in the industry right now from the old guard to the new guard. And it happened in the 90s and even in the 80s for that matter, you know, as architecture shifted from mainframe to client server, from client server to the internet from internet to appliances and virtualization to then the cloud. I think, you know, every decade has seen that baton passing, and I think there's going to be a baton passing from the old to the new, and that's where consolidation really happens. And there is some element of fatigue and all sorts of things that create consolidation as well, but I foresee this next 3 years to be hyperactive when it comes to consolidation.
So to wrap up, maybe Dheeraj, can you maybe talk a little bit about what do you think is most misunderstood as part of the Nutanix story in the investment community today? I'm sure you talk to Dustin and investors directly and to the IR team as well. What is your impression of what is most misunderstood in the story, and how do you think that gets resolved?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're a complicated story. We are in the arena, and the folks who are the front row seat, they get it. You know, the long-term folks who have been with us for the last 6-7 years as investors, they get it. But because we did this transition 3 years ago and have been going through this, it's a complicated story just for that reason alone, actually, you know. People in the bleachers, they obviously just don't get it. But I think it's a rite of passage, you know. What we do, what is cloud software, why should I even have cloud software, has been a journey of the last several years and probably will be for the next several years itself. I think the other piece is profitability and all that stuff. And again, I just want investors to know that, you know, between 2015 and 19, we burned $75 million and we grew the business 5-6x, and we are extremely paranoid about efficiency and profitability. You know, we're still a 10-year-old company. So in the next 3 to 5 years, what could happen to us is, and that train has left the station as when we started the transition 3 years ago, in the next couple of years, will be a very different company.
Perfect. Well, Dheeraj, we really appreciate all your thoughts and your insights. It's always a pleasure to have these calls with you, and I feel like I learned something at the end of each of these that gives me some food for thought. So thank you so much for taking the time. I hope you're staying safe, and wish you guys the very best, and talk soon.
Thank you, Vamsi. And again, questions are always insightful. They push me to think hard. And thanks to the audience as well for their time. Stay safe, but take care of yourself. Take care of each other.
Thanks, Dheeraj.
This is the Tech Barometer podcast from The Forecast. That was the Bank of America View from the Top CEO Insight Call. Nutanix CEO Dheeraj Pandey spoke with Bank of America Senior Tech Analyst Wamsi Mohan. Tech Barometer is produced by The Forecast, and you can find more tech content, stories, and podcasts at theforecastbynutanix.com.